I fully believed in the mission. I fully believed Secretary Rumsfeld when he said that we had the worst of the worst at Guantanamo. And I had no doubt in my mind at that time that I was going there to fulfill a kind of personal pledge that I had made back in September 2001, and that is to do whatever I could to bring justice to these terrorists and also to, if you will, avenge the wrongs that had been done to our country.
It isn't an exaggeration to say that by the time you got there, the detention camp had been condemned around the world. What did you think about what human rights organizations and foreign governments were saying about Guantanamo?
I dismissed them as ideologically based. What I viewed them as doing was politicizing Guantanamo in order to increase their charitable revenue.
Considering what you've told me about your thoughts and beliefs at that time, it sounds like this role was perfect for you, prosecuting the men that President Bush and various administration officials described as America's enemies.
Yes, and I took on that role eagerly. At one point, I was assigned as the lead prosecutor for one-third of the cases that were pending before the commissions. And this is out of an office with perhaps 20 to 25 prosecutors.
So what happened? When did you start to have concerns?
I started to have concerns almost immediately after arriving. When I walked through the offices, I saw that cases had not been developed, evidence hadn't been collected and cataloged.
What in particular started to concern you about the use of evidence?
Well, the first thing that I learned when I read through the Military Commissions Act was that evidence that had been obtained through coercion, a term not defined in the legislation or the regulations that implemented them, could be admissible in court. I was also concerned about the use of hearsay and then also what we would call double hearsay. That is, to give you an example, Joe could testify that John told me that Richard told him that Abdullah did X, Y, or Z. That would never be admissible in a United States court. And, of course, coerced testimony would never be admissible.
How sure were you that the evidence you were looking at had been gathered through coercion?
At first, I wasn't. The first case that I really began to delve into was United States versus Muhammad Jawad, which seemed to me to be at the time a simple street crime. The allegations were that a 16 or 17-year-old Afghan who had trained for a foreign terrorist organization threw a grenade into the back of a Jeep-like vehicle being driven by a couple of U.S. Special Forces soldiers and their interpreter. It seemed to me to be not an open-and-shut case because there really aren't any, but a simple case and a simple case to prove.
You came across a testimony from this man that he had been tortured.
Well, I did, actually, and it was entirely through happenstance. I was sitting in another prosecutor's office at his desk using his computer because mine was then being worked on. I happened to look over, and I saw the record of a trial that had taken place about a year before. So I picked up the record of trial, and I was flipping through it just to find out why this individual had been charged and acquitted. And I saw in this file for the very first time, despite my extensive search of the various databases we had access to and despite numerous requests to the investigative agencies involved, and despite having gone to Afghanistan, I found a statement from Mr. Jawad in the record of trial. Now, under the rules, that absolutely had to have been turned over to the defense immediately. And if I hadn't been sitting at that desk, if I hadn't had the curiosity to open that file, if I hadn't flipped through that file, I would never have found it, and I would have been in breach of the rules and of my professional ethics. We haven't given him all the evidence to which he's entitled. We haven't complied with the rules.
How many examples do you think exist where evidence wasn't given to the defense, which should have been?
I have no way of knowing. And the reason I have no way of knowing, and one of the reasons why I asked to be reassigned from the commissions, was because the evidence had not been, as I said, cataloged. In fact, the evidence was in a state of chaos.
How would you describe this transformation of your views? You went from what you describe as a true believer to feeling what?
Oh, I went from being a true believer to one who felt truly deceived. And it happened in the most anguished way I've ever experienced, by being confronted with indisputable evidence that what was going on was morally wrong, was incompatible with American values, was incompatible and almost inconceivable given my mind frame. I've been a conformist all my life. I've been a true believer all my life. I am an American first person from the day I was born almost. And so it was a shattering experience to have to come to the realization that what we were doing at Guantanamo was wrong.
You said in a testimony to a hearing in Guantanamo that the military commission system is, and I'll quote here, not served by having someone who may be innocent convicted of a crime. Do you really believe this could happen?
Oh, absolutely. It's a prosecutor's worst nightmare to have someone who is innocent convicted and serving a sentence in prison. It is not inconceivable to me that that could happen at Guantanamo, given the rules that have been set up and given, as I've described, the state of utter chaos that exists down there. I thought that the military commissions were part of a grand tradition in accordance with the highest of American values. From an insider's point of view, now I see them as having defiled the U.S. Constitution, and I see them as a stain on America. But probably most important, I see them as tainting our fighting men and women who are in harm's way. And really, it's for them that I'm here today speaking out.